It is the Lake Show, Steve in for Henry tonight. Typically, I'm in on Saturdays, and I will be in tomorrow starting at 3. We'll have Tech Talk, Doug Swinhart, computer problems, hardware, software, etc. Between 3 and 4. We'll follow the Twins and the Braves, first Grapefruit League game of the year. And we'll be on the air at noon. Chris Atterbury, Dan Gladden with all the action at noon tomorrow here on CCO. Henry returns Monday night. Chris Tubbs will be back Monday night. Our producer is Jonathan Lowe. Right now we're pleased to be joined by Stephen Clark. He covers space flight for Ars Technica. And I've been visiting with Stephen on the radio now for a number of years. And Stephen, thanks so much for the time tonight. Good to visit with you.
Good to be with you, Steve. Always a pleasure.
I know we have touched on this as of late, but if I was a contractor or someone working on the space launch system or in the Artemis program, I would be very nervous.
Yes, I would as well. I think that program is likely to face, at a minimum, significant changes, if not outright cancellation and a complete pivot potentially toward Mars. Obviously, that is the goal of Elon Musk, and he has a lot of influence right now in the Trump administration and within NASA. And there are lots of arguments to make that NASA should change the way they do business, but there are also good arguments to make, in my opinion, about potential conflicts of interest with SpaceX and Elon Musk having a lot of influence in decisions that will benefit their pocketbook or checkbook, basically. So I think that it's a really interesting time, really kind of unforeseen time, really. I would have never imagined a year ago that we would be in this place. There, like I said, there are a lot of good arguments to cancel the space launch system. It is exorbitantly expensive. NASA spent $29 billion of taxpayer money on this program since 2011. It has not launched people yet. It'll cost $2.5 billion just for the rocket to launch each of these missions to the moon. So there are cheaper ways to do this, but I think there are legitimate questions to raise about the motivations behind it.
Yeah, and I think we can start with that part of it. Even during the Biden administration, there was a lot of talk about this is incredibly expensive and, for all practical purposes, 100% disposable. And delay after delay after delay, and then concerns about the heat shield on the capsule. As we know, this gigantic rocket launched once, sent an unmanned capsule around the moon and came back, but there's been concerns about the integrity of the heat shield associated with it, and once again, more and more delays. And then this next one would just be a manned mission, but actually wouldn't land on the moon, would just take a trip around the moon and come back. And as you're talking about, it just keeps getting pushed out and out, and more money is spent. And I think whether Elon Musk is involved or not, you have to wonder, is this sustainable over the long haul? And, you know, when eventually, if this program was sustained, would they meet the goal of people walking on the moon again?
I'll answer my opinion on both those questions. It's not sustainable. And the second part, is it technically feasible? I think yes. However, the space launch system, a lot of people wanted that canceled for a long time. It's taken way too long. It's been way too expensive. You know, this thing was supposed to launch when the program was announced. It was supposed to be ready for its first human launch before 2020. And now it's going to be at least a year from now, 2026, before it flies humans. And that's, given the history of the program, that's still questionable. And as you mentioned, that upcoming mission is just going to be carrying the crew of four astronauts around the far side of the moon and back to Earth. That in and of itself is an impressive feat. It hasn't been done since the 1970s, but still a few years at least away from landing on the moon. And the space launch system there are alternatives available to it. No question about it. Beginning with SpaceX themselves, the Starship rocket, which is in development. I still think it's a few years away from being to a point, even if they, you know, even if all the regulatory hurdles are shoved aside and, SpaceX has free rein access to both internal money and government funding for the program. I still think their Starship is 3 years, 4 years away from even launching people at all. And so that's one alternative. The other alternative that NASA could look at is using existing rockets like SpaceX's Falcon Heavy or Blue Origin. The company owned by Jeff Bezos just launched their first Nuklein rocket last month successfully. Those are both very heavy lift rockets that could together create some sort of architecture where you could launch one piece of the mission going to the moon, a capsule, for example, on one rocket, launch the lander or launch an upper stage or kick stage on another rocket to get them out toward the moon. Both those rockets don't match the capability of the Space Launch System or Starship, though. So going back to the drawing board, I think inevitably in the near term, in my view, would delay getting humans back to the moon. And if the Trump administration wants to put people on the moon for a big victorious triumphant accomplishment before the end of the term, I'm not convinced that going another way would do it, but going another way would be cheaper and it would be more sustainable.
Yeah, so big decisions coming there. And then beyond that, we need to get to a couple of things that have been talked about very recently, and that is the push. And we all know, and we have talked about this over and over for a number of years, about Elon Musk and SpaceX. And the ultimate goal with SpaceX, and for that matter, even the Starlink constellation, is to provide funds for his dream to have humans walk and then ultimately colonize Mars. I mean, that is still the focus, and he is very adamant about that and still talks about that goal. And with his influence, you could see those dollars that were flowing to NASA for all these other things like the Artemis program, et cetera, and other initiatives being poured into ultimately having humans, Americans, be the first to Mars. But it's one thing to go to the moon, which was done in the 60s. We're finding the challenges of just getting back to the moon tremendous. Mm-hmm. It is a quantum leap to have humans survive to Mars, land on Mars, and then hit the next window to be able to come back to Earth. I mean, this is daunting. And to think that would be done in the next 4 or 5 years, I can't. It's impossible. It can't be done.
I agree fully, Steve. And I hope to be alive to see the first human land on Mars. I really do. I think that would be one of the most impressive accomplishments in the history of humanity, to be honest. I don't want to overstate it, but my goodness, that would be a really, really, watershed moment in civilization. But I think I think the best case scenario for landing humans on Mars is probably 10 to 15 years from now. And that's, again, if you go all out, full court press, you do, throw the Artemis program aside, you cut NASA's budget in other areas to go all in on going to Mars. Elon Musk also will be co-funding this if that happens with his own funds. It'll be a public-private partnership, I'm sure, to make it happen. But just a couple of challenges of going to Mars that I would put out for your listeners. One of them is the Starship architecture that SpaceX has developed and is testing right now to be able to eventually go to Mars. It has to be refueled several times in Earth orbit to be able to go out to the moon or Mars. That's probably something that can be achieved and tested and mastered in a number of a few years, perhaps in 4 or 5 years. But getting out to Mars requires all sorts of sophisticated life support systems, that some of which are being tested on the International Space Station right now, some successfully, some not so successfully, because when you're going out to Mars, you can't, you know, you can't carry all your replacements with you. You can't carry a stock room full of spare parts with you. You can't go to a shop and get something repaired. You're months or years away from coming back to Earth on when you're on that trajectory going out to Mars. And the other thing is, once you land on Mars, you mentioned you have to find the right timing, the right positions of the planets to be able to launch off Mars and come back to Earth. The other thing is with Starship, you know, it can land 100 tons on Mars, so it could, you know, carry a bunch of cargo to Mars, and it will need to, because in order to come back to Earth, it will have to be able to generate some sort of propellant on Mars, either generate propellant or send missions in advance to store propellant on Mars. So you have to have basically a stockpile of propellant or a robotic propellant manufacturing facility. You can generate propellant by harvesting ice from the Martian soil. It's very complicated. That's the point I'm trying to get across. And, you know, to say this is going to happen in 4 or 5 years, I think is not realistic. Even if you did things like cancel Artemis or cancel the International Space Station, which Elon Musk has also proposed in recent days.
Yeah, and my concern is that with the growing influence that this would be, it could turn into some sort of Manhattan Project, and I just don't know what the return is other than the accomplishment of getting there and returning alive. That, and I get into the human thing as much as anything. You talk technology, and rightfully so. Where is Starship now? Where is our ability with chemical rockets right now? And you talked about refueling. And let's say that we've been able to get robotic missions to Mars and land those on Mars successfully. But there's also the human component when you're sending humans. I was thinking about this during the 3-week cold snap. 3 weeks of below average temperatures here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Wind chills in the 20s and 30s below zero. People didn't want to go outside. They'd go from their home to their car or from their car to work and didn't spend a lot of time outside because it wasn't healthy. But you still could go outside and breathe the air. It was bitterly cold. And that's true in Arizona in the summertime. It could be 117 degrees, but you can still go outside and breathe the air. If you're in a stainless steel can for months at a time, and that's it. I'm wondering about the psychology of that, and have we truly tested it? Because you can't say, well, submariners and nuclear submarines are submerged for weeks at a time. But if they had to, they could come to the surface and breathe the air. People on the wagon trains traveling across the Old West, they could always catch the rainwater and breathe the air. You don't have that luxury. You're in a stainless steel can for months at a time and are reliant on those life support systems, period. And this could be for what? The window could be 2 years, 3 years of living that way. I don't think the human part of it has been explored nearly enough.
Those are all good points, Steve. And you're right. It would take it's a multi-year expedition to go to Mars and come back. There are risks really untold. I haven't seen a real rigorous accounting of the risks of going to Mars in terms of a probability of loss of life. They're not only just the necessity to store or create propellant on Mars. You're also worried about radiation on the journey to Mars. That is something that has never really been fully explored. The concepts that I've seen right now is if there's a big solar flare while someone's on a journey to Mars, they take cover in a vault essentially, and then in order to protect against the radiation, how heavy is that vault? You have to be able to launch that off the Earth with a rocket, and it takes up mass that you could use for fuel or for supplies or anything like that. So there are so many unanswered questions, and And it's true that the that NASA's approach has been lacking, in my opinion. It's it's mired in bureaucracy. It's also NASA's goals are the way our government works are basically created by committee in Congress. You know, the president can propose and execute, but Congress will appropriate funds as they see fit. And
spread
I'm not
the money
sure.
around. Yeah,
exactly.
Spread the
different
money around.
Different states. Yeah, precisely. And one thing that, you know, a couple of days ago, Elon Musk put on X, formerly Twitter, that he wanted to bring the International Space Station back, deorbit it, and, you know, put it in the ocean, re-enter it, and it'll burn up in 2 years in order to use that funding. It's about $2 or $3 billion a year that the space station costs to operate, to redirect that toward Mars. Now, you know, the International Space Station is operated from Houston, in a red state, and Ted Cruz, a Republican senator from Texas, has been one of the biggest supporters of the International Space Station since he's been in the Senate for over a decade now. And I'm told he is not going to be on board with that, with deorbiting the International Space Station in 2 years, just out of his own interests and his own constituency in Texas.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's going to be true even with the Artemis program and the Space Launch System that we talked about at the top, that impacts a lot of districts and a lot of jobs and a lot of industries that are relying on that particular program. And once that moves to the chopping block, you know, look out. And I do want to get into that in more detail and a couple of other items. Quick break, Stephen. Stephen Clark joining us from Ars Technica. He covers Bay's flight and joins us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline here on News Talk. 830-WCCO. It is the Lake Show. Stephen for Henry. He'll be back Monday night with Chris Tubbs. Steve Thompson once again with Jonathan Lowe and our guest, Stephen Clark from Ars Technica. He covers space flight. And we've talked a lot about this idea of going to Mars, and you did bring up the International Space Station. And, Stephen, wasn't this scheduled to be deorbited? And, by the way, SpaceX won the contract to do that in around 2030, about 5 years from now.
That is correct. That is correct, Steve. That's the consensus among the United States and its international partners, which include Canada, the European Space Agency, and Japan, and Russia. Russia, however, has only committed to 2028, although in recent months, really, you know, during in 2022 and in the immediate aftermath of their invasion of Ukraine, there were threats from Russia that they would want to pull out of the space station immediately or perhaps by 2024. They did extend that to 2028, and I believe they are interested in extending it further to 2030 or even into the 2030s at this point. That their tune has changed even before the incoming Trump administration. That was kind of discussed last year. So, deorbiting the International Space Station in 2 years, a number of issues that come up with that. One of those is, are the international partners, including Russia, going to be on board with that? Because that is a significant chunk of their space programs and all these partners that I mentioned. And it's the only human spaceflight program for Russia. And if there's a rapprochement between the United States and Russia under the Trump administration, you know, I don't think Putin wants to deorbit the International Space Station in 2 years, frankly. And so that's a question mark there. The other is, another one is, the International Space Station is being used to develop technologies and develop a so-called market for commercial space stations in low Earth orbit, which could replace the International Space Station in the 2030s. There's still some technical issues with that are being, you know, technology experiments on the space station with life support systems and robotics that could, those learnings from those experiments could feed into those commercial space stations, and those experiments won't be completed in 2 years. And then the other thing is, if the International Space Station is deorbited, the U.S. will lose, at least for a temporary time, even if the focus turns completely to the Mars or even the Moon, the U.S. will lose their foothold in low Earth orbit. There won't be a destination for astronauts to go to in space for a number of years. And that will cede that capability to China, because China will be the only China at that point would own the only human-tended space station in orbit for a number of years. So I don't think that is something that's going to be very popular in the U.S. government either.
Yeah, and their capability continues to grow, and we don't have a lot of time left. And maybe the next time we visit, we should maybe focus on exactly what they're doing, because that is the fuel for a space race. As Elon Musk gains more and more influence and more capability, the Chinese are not sitting still either. They have landed a probe on the far side of the moon. They have ambitions to get to Mars. They have ambitions to do more and more. And there is certainly the money and the commitment to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. China has a goal of landing their own astronauts on the moon in by 2030. And so, you know, the previous NASA administrator, Bill Nelson, under President Biden, essentially it was said in these words exactly, that we're in a race with China in getting back to the moon. There's a new space race in the 2020s going on between these two superpowers. Now, you know, if NASA redirects toward Mars and kind of abandons the moon, then we're talking about China having the sole human presence on the moon, as NASA and SpaceX presumably partnered to go to Mars. Of course, going to Mars is a quote unquote higher ground than the moon, but I'm willing to bet that China has a good shot of landing humans on the moon before the United States can land humans on Mars.
I'm just at this moment, and I've been a big fan since Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I'm old enough to remember it. I was 5 years old and watching it my Grandma and Grandpa's living room when Neil Armstrong did step on the moon in July of 1969, and have been a fan ever since. I'm highly skeptical that the technology exists to keep humans alive on the way to Mars, land them on Mars, and return them safely to Earth. I'll go back to that point earlier. That is a long way off, in my opinion. We'll see.
I don't disagree, Steve. I think that's, like I said, I don't see it happening, let's say, before 2040. I would put the over-under in 2040, and that may be optimistic for me.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the work you do, and really enjoy reading your work and the work of your colleagues at Ars Technica. And hopefully we can do it again soon. And I would like to spend more time talking about what China is doing and what their plan is, because, once again, their capability continues to grow.
Yeah, that's a hot topic in the industry right now, and we'd love to chat with you next time about that.
All right, Stephen. Very good. Stephen Clark, once again, joining us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Quick break. We'll have an update on the weather. We'll get you up to date on the girls' state hockey tournament. We have a final. Looks like the Hill Murray Pioneers are headed back to the title game. Will they play Edina or Holy Family? They'll drop the puck on that one shortly in St. Paul. Quite a day over there. Some great games in the girls state hockey tournament. Timberwolves underway. The Wild get started tomorrow. And then Jonathan Lowell close out the show with headlines here on News Talk 830 WCCO. Henry's had a couple of nights off. He'll be back next week here on the Lake Show. Chris Tubbs the night off, Jonathan Lowell. They went to the bullpen, so to speak, tonight. And always good to work with Jonathan Lowe. We worked together on the weekends for a long time. Now I'm in on Saturday, and he's in on Sundays. But we do team up on Saturdays for college football final. And college football final away is off.
And don't be surprised, Mr. Thompson, if I might make a suggestion here in, about a month, to come in on a Saturday and talk a little NCAA tournament action.
We should have you come in, talk some hoops. That's good. I like it a lot. If you're up for it, I'm certainly up for it.
I'm always down to talk hoops, sir.
Hey, great games today at the girls state hockey tournament semifinals in 1A and 2A today, and you heard it in the news. Waro Norino played one for the books, three overtimes. Warroad wins it 2-1 in that third overtime. Number one seed Dodge County beat Holy Angels 4-1. So Warroad from the north, Dodge County from the south for the title tomorrow at the Xcel Energy Center. And then tonight, game one, Hill Murray beat Rosemount 5-2. I saw Hill Murray in their section final at Aldrich beat Woodbury, and they were phenomenal. And they have four seniors that play, and then they've got eighth graders, ninth graders, sophomores that contribute big time on this team. And John Pohl's the head coach. His wife, Chrissy Wendell, now Chrissy Pohl, on the bench. And then they have two daughters on the team, Emily and Anna. So a real family affair at Hill Murray. And they were the runners-up a year ago to Edina, and just a fine team. And what's kind of scary for the rest of the state, they are loaded, and they are going to be a factor for the next few years, the way it looks. And once again, they beat Rosemount 5-2. And one semifinal in Holy Family and Edina getting ready to drop the puck in St. Paul. State gymnastics team titles will be decided tonight down the hall at Roy Wilkins Auditorium. And then individual champions will be crowned. So a lot going on with girls hockey and gymnastics in St. Paul. So a great week. And then, of course, section finals and boys hockey next week. State wrestling tournament next week in St. Paul. And then before you know it, girls and boys hoops crank up. And the big boys state hockey tournament. Boys swimming and diving, a lot going on in high school sports. Timberwolves getting underway in Houston. We did learn Mike Conley and Anthony Edwards are in tonight. Rudy Gobert out with back spasms. Certainly not good. And it is a late start tonight in Houston. And then they have another late one coming up on Sunday against OKC. It's one thing to start late on a Friday night or a Saturday night. I hate those late starts on a school night. Hey, you know, the kids got to go to bed, and the old men got to go to bed. You know, I ain't staying up late for that. I know OKC, they lead the West. You got the Timberwolves. Could be a potential playoff matchup. Jonathan Lowe, I'm not going to be up for the end of that one on Sunday night. Sorry. Not going
to
do it.
I'm the wrong person to say
You're a bit of a night owl.
I'm a night owl. Okay. Number one, I'll be here Sunday evening.
Yeah, but you're out the door at 9, aren't you?
I'm basically just after 9, yes.
Okay.
But I will be staying up to watch more than likely. I go to bed way later than I should. Don't tell nobody. But yes, so I more than likely will be up for that full game. Probably start watching it here a little bit and then head over to some establishment, let's say, and finish watching the game there.
You know, Sunday I'm up a little bit later because of Friday and Saturday night I kind of ease back. You get me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night. If I'm in bed by like 9:30, I'm happy as a clam. So 8:30 tip on a Sunday night, no way. And you know, once upon a time when I was younger, I'd stay up for the West Coast games, whether the Wild or the Timberwolves were in L.A. or the Bay Area or way back in the day. Up in Seattle, certainly in Portland, but Vancouver, or for the Wild, Calgary, that sort of thing. But I can't do it anymore.
So here's
not on a school night.
Here's a quick question, then, just based off of that fact. The NBA is trying to expand. They're looking to expand.
Seattle and Vegas.
Those are the favorites.
Well,
are you rooting for Seattle and Vegas to come in so that possibly Minnesota can be shifted from the Western Conference to the Eastern Conference?
Well, and you look at I have thought about that a lot. I think Seattle's a no-brainer. I thought it was terrible when they moved to Oklahoma City. So, and I'd love if they brought back the Supersonics. I thought that was a great nickname. And there is no doubt the NBA is going to be in Vegas. The NHL was first. You got the NFL now. MLB is on the way, allegedly. The NBA is going to be in Vegas. I would assume Seattle's just a no-brainer. They got to get the building worked out and all of that. And I don't know if they're going to play in the home of the Kraken or not, if that's been decided. But I would think, based on that, that would mean the Timberwolves could shift and be potentially play more games against the likes of Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis. I mean, much, much easier travel in the East than the West. So, yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, the two candidates that I would think would be moved are either Minnesota or Memphis.
Yeah,
I would think those would be the top two candidates. If Seattle and Vegas come in and you need to shift someone over to the East, I believe Minnesota and Memphis would be the two that you would look at and say, okay, these, again, you would think geography would play into it, but we know sports doesn't work that way.
Well, we're right. And then you got New Orleans, you got the Texas teams, you got OKC. That's a no-brainer to keep out west, because really those are reasonable trips. You know, New Orleans, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, OKC, reasonable trip out to Denver. That all makes a lot of sense. Hey, we got to break headlines. Jonathan Lowe with headlines to close it out here on News Talk 830 WCCO. All right, let's get right to it. Jonathan Lowe, headlines, what do you got?
Okay, this first one's a little longer, but I'll try to get through this as quickly as possible. In Murder at the Lighthouse, a thriller filmed in the Duluth area over 11 days this past fall, a woman with an abusive partner hires a fishing boat captain to ferry her across Lake Superior and into Canada. After an accident on the big lake, she is washed ashore and then helped along by a lighthouse keeper. But is that lighthouse keeper actually helping her? Murder at the Lighthouse premieres Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lifetime, with streaming available starting the next day. It's another in a growing line of movies that producer Mary Jane Turpin has made in northeastern Minnesota. The 90-minute film features northern Minnesota vistas, including the Duluth South Breakwater Inner and the Superior Entry Lighthouses, a private residence in Saginaw, and a store in Twig. Sherry Marshick, executive producer of the Upper Midwest Film Office, said this region is coming off of a filmmaking dry spell after the 2023 Writers Guild of America strike. Every project that is made here matters, she said. Getting the eyeballs of the production industry to think about northern Minnesota, or Minnesota in general, is very important. Turpin has more films planned for this area that can serve as an on-the-job training for locals looking for experience in the industry. She's even bought a house here. The Northland should be busy this year, which we're looking forward to, really looking forward to, Turpin said.
I'm looking forward to that. I love that stuff. Now, some of the movies made here over the years, not that great. Grumpy Old Man, that was pretty good. Jingle All the Way, eh.
Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, Mighty Ducks, yeah. Some of the scenes, how about this one? You might not be old enough to remember that Robbie Benson movie, Ice Castles.
No, I think it came along when I was alive.
They used the old Mariucci Arena for that.
Anyway. No, I never saw that, no.
Yeah, don't bother.
Anyway, but it's great to know that places like northern Minnesota, people are branching out to places like northern Minnesota for the film industry. That's really cool.
It is very cool, and the Big Lake, that is a great backdrop.
Yes,
sure,
absolutely. All right, a much more serious story. Officials in Maui are investigating a Thursday night explosion at a beach resort that reportedly injured more than half a dozen people, sending several to hospitals. According to information from the Maui Police Department, the blast took place just before 6:15 Hawaiian time, at a set of condos at, Ka'anapali Beach, located just northwest of the northwest part of the island in Hawaii. Officers responded to an address at the Whaler Resort at Ka'anapali Parkway for a report of a miscellaneous accident, the department posted on its social media page. No evacuations were conducted, police wrote in the release. Preliminary investigations suggest that the explosion may have involved liquefied petroleum gas, LPG, which supplies common area barbecues, KHON2 TV reported via the Maui police. Witness statements indicate a possible grill malfunction before the incident.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Just my luck, I'd go to Hawaii and there'd be some sort of grill explosion.
Yeah. Well, wow. Fortunately, it seems like there were three people that suffered critical injuries.
Ouch.
So we'll continue. Hopefully we can continue to monitor the story, see what happens. But hopefully everybody turns out okay.
All right. Do we have time for one more?
I'm going to squeeze this in a little bit real quick. Private equity firms Apollo Global Management and Sycamore Partners are among the bidders who are competing to acquire Family Dollar, a discount retail chain operated by Dollar Tree, according to people familiar with the matter. Investment firm Brigade Capital Management has also expressed interest in buying Family Dollar, sources said, requesting anonymity as the discussions are confidential. A deal for Family Dollar, which could value the retailer at several billion dollars, is not imminent, the sources said, cautioning that Dollar Tree could choose not to sell the business. It is also possible that a different suitor for Family Dollar could emerge. Chesapeake, Virginia-based Dollar Tree has been working with investment bankers at JPMorgan Chase to explore options, including a potential sale or spinoff for Family Dollar, since June of last year. The move marked a reversal for Dollar Tree, which acquired Family Dollar in 2015 for about $9 billion after outbidding its biggest rival, Dollar General. Since the takeover, Family Dollar has struggled with its performance, and its growth has stalled as the discount retailer has been unable to attract new customers. The performance has lagged behind larger retailers such as Walmart and Target as well.
How about that? The dollar store is worth billions.
Kind of ironic, isn't it?
It really is. Jonathan, always great. Enjoy your Friday night. Once again, Timberwolves getting underway. And I'll be back tomorrow following the Twins and the Braves Grapefruit League opener. Big thanks to all our guests. Most of all, thanks to you for tuning in. Henry's back next week here on CCO.